Okay, let's bring the council to order. Council, come to order. Carla, could you call the roll, please? Or should, I ask, or should I do my thing about the mayor being on the phone first?
I'll do the roll.
Do that first?
We'll do the roll.
Okay, pursuant to city code, we need to take a vote about allowing Mayor Hales to participate by telephone. And, or it's not a vote, it's really asking my fellow colleagues if they have any objection. Failure to participate in today's council session, I think, would jeopardize public interest, health, safety, or welfare. And therefore, I ask my colleagues if anybody objects to the mayor participating by telephone. Seeing no objections, welcome Mayor Hales. Carla, please call the roll.
Novick? Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Hales?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here. Okay, so we are, could you please read item 989?
Extend the emergency housing declared by ordinance 187371 to address increased homelessness, identify council powers, specify 3-year duration, and waive portions of the zoning code.
Mayor Hales, did you wish to make any opening statement?
I do. Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman, and thank you for accommodating me calling in for my vacation, because this is an important discussion this afternoon. I'm very glad that we're all going to be here to participate in. We're here, of course, because there is a housing and homelessness crisis. It's a national crisis. It's particularly acute on the West Coast, and it's particularly acute in our city. It's a crisis of families being priced out of their apartments, forced to be sleeping in their cars, of children getting ready for school, living in a tent, of people working full-time and still unable to afford their rent. Last year, we had the highest increase in housing costs in the nation, a list no one wants to be first on. We went up 11% from 2015 to 2016 in our average cost of housing in the city of Portland. And yet, we still have 1,000 people a month moving to our city, in part driving that demand for housing. Our 2015 point-in-time count found, in terms of homelessness, that we have 1,800 Portlanders unsheltered, sleeping in their cars or in tents or on the street. And so for all those reasons, last year we unanimously declared a state of emergency in housing and homelessness, recognizing that this is an urgent crisis and that we need to respond. What does that state of emergency mean in practice? First, it has meant rapid action. We've opened hundreds of new shelter beds with governmental, private sector, and faith partners. Second, it means deliberate experimentation. We've launched some successful pilot projects, like opening day storage units for people to store their belongings during the day so they can job hunt or go to medical appointments. And third, it's meant real money. This city council has committed unprecedented levels of funding towards housing and homelessness. If you add up everything we've committed and that what we've sent to the voters for approval this fall, it's $500 million. The state of emergency also signaled to local, state, and federal partners that we're serious about making real progress. And because of our state of emergency, the United States Housing Secretary, Julian Castro, attended the first ever West Coast Mayors Summit, which I convened here in Portland back in December. And with my colleagues from Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Eugene, we asked for more resources to address this emergency, and Secretary Castro has advised us on how to get it done. Because of our state of emergency, our Office of Government Relations was able to tell the Oregon Legislature that our housing situation is serious, and they lifted the preemption on inclusionary zoning, thanks in no small part, Commissioner Saltzman, to your advocacy down there in Salem. And with the state of emergency, the Planning Bureau is fast-tracking incorporating inclusionary zoning into our city code, and we can also fast-track code changes to allow homeless shelters to be more easily sited. Because of our state of emergency, local partners have come together in unprecedented ways. The historic partnership between the city and the county with our Joint Office of Homelessness Services launched in July, just recently started running the Hanson Shelter for 200 people. Most importantly, though,
The state of emergency has signaled to everyone in our community that we recognize that this is a crisis, this is a struggle, and we're going to dedicate resources and public policy to addressing it. So I'm proud that we've made some great progress, but we all recognize that we're still in a state of emergency. We still have people being priced out of their apartments. We still have children getting ready for school in tents or living in cars. We still have people working full-time who can't afford to live in our city. And we are in a state of emergency, and that's why this declaration makes sense and does make sense to continue it. So I want to thank everyone for this discussion today. I know we have some panels lined up. Mr. Saltzman starting with one led by Chad Stover, and I appreciate hearing from them and from everybody in the community on this important topic.
Okay, thank you, Mayor. So, yes, we'll start with the invited testimony, and we'll start with Chad Stover, the Policy Director of Livability in the Mayor's Office. And Chair, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori.
Good afternoon, Mayor. Good afternoon, City Commissioners. My name is Chad Stover. I'm Policy Director of Livability, Office of the Mayor. And before we actually get into the presentation part, I would like to ask my colleague Rachel Wiggins to come up and discuss a little bit about the substitute ordinance that was submitted.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Council. Rachel Wiggins, Mayor's Office. In front of you is a substitute ordinance. I thought I would briefly run through the changes and then ask Council to put it on the table for discussion. Okay. First and foremost, it changes the duration from 3 years down to one. I think we heard loud and clear that the Council was comfortable with renewing it for 1 year. Two, there are some changes to the directives that reflect work that's currently happening underneath the current state of emergency, specifically around streamlining the review process for affordable housing, that's Directive E, and proposing code amendments that will be coming to the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Additionally, in there is a reporting requirement for the director of the Joint Office on Homelessness, as well as the housing director, to come to Council every 6 months and give a report out on the work that's being done and give Council the opportunity to evaluate whether or not emergency is still needed. Lastly, there is a strike through a directive that that lays out anything else that was in the previous ordinance is being carried forward in this one. 99% of this ordinance is the last ordinance. The only change is that we are no longer asking the governor to declare a state of emergency, so it didn't make sense to have that directive in there.
Okay, great.
I'm going to move this substitute ordinance.
Second to put it on the table.
Okay, so the substitute is now before us, and we will thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
And we'll go back to Mr. Stover.
Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman. I do have a PowerPoint, and I would like to hand out. I made some hard copy handouts that will coincide with what you see on the screen, and I will hand these to Carla. Thank you, Carla.
Mr. President, do we need to remind folks to?
Yes, if you agree with the speaker or disagree with the speaker, please don't verbalize those concerns, but use your hands, like hands up, thumbs down. Yeah, no yays.
No.
Okay. Mr. Stover, take it away.
Carla, do you have an extra one? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good afternoon. The City of Portland and regional partners have taken extraordinary steps and made unprecedented progress in addressing livability issues associated with homelessness, including dedicating $356.35 million to affordable housing, rent assistance, homelessness outreach, and related programs. The tools provided within the state of emergency in housing and homelessness remain necessary to address Portland's crisis. Under a state of emergency in housing and homelessness, Portland has established regional partnerships, $20 million investment in the creation of city-county regional partnerships such as A Home for Everyone and the Joint Office of Homeless Services. We've created new tenant protections, new regulations requiring landlords to provide tenants with 90-day notices for no-cause evictions and 90-day notices for potential rent increases of 5% or more. We've dedicated over $500 million toward permanent affordable housing, $67 million from increased urban renewal tax increment financing set aside to 45%, resulting in $284 million to affordable housing over 10 years, $1.2 million in lodging taxes from short-term rentals dedicated to affordable housing, $48.4 million additional Portland Housing Bureau funding in the fiscal year 2015-2016 budget, $8 million from 1% construction excise tax on residential and commercial construction. Referred to an affordable housing bond to the November ballot for voters to decide whether to raise an additional $258 million for affordable housing. Some of the actions when it comes to shelters. We opened up the Sears shelter and the Menasche Peace Shelter, both temporary, now closed. We opened the Hanson shelter, opened on July 22nd, which included 200 beds. The Portland Gresham Border Women's Shelter will be opening early September, and that includes 90 beds. And then the McLaughlin Resource Center, which will also be opening in early November, which includes 120 beds. A note about this, once we get these two buildings opened, we will be at 475 shelter beds out of the 650 shelter bed goal that we set to accomplish by the end of the 2017 fiscal year. So we'll have about 175 more beds to go once we get those two shelters opened up. We included opening of the first Congregational Church, which had 13 beds, followed by Rose City United Methodist, which has 25 beds. So as it turns out, the first Congregational Church sunset. So once the Rose City United Methodist opened up, we got 25 new beds. So that's not on top of the 13. The 25s replaced the 13 and then added 12 more. In January of 2015, we set out a goal to house 695 homeless veterans, and we achieved that by December of 2016. Also during the past year, we've, as the mayor pointed out, we've been engaging in a lot of intentional experimentation. We've created new innovative pilot programs, such as the Homelessness Toolkit. This is an online resource for Portlanders to receive information and updates on homelessness policies, services, and future programming. We started the One Point of Contact program. This is a reporting tool to streamline public reporting of livability issues related to homelessness camping, regardless of jurisdiction. There have been, on average, 280 reports per week and 6,000 to date. Since October of 2015, when we began our state of emergency, we've conducted approximately 186 campsite cleanups. We have the sanitation pilot. Portable toilets and dumpsters have been placed in strategic areas around the city that are in need of sanitation services. This reduces human waste on the public right-of-way and in other areas. We began the day storage pilot. This includes two storage containers that include portable toilets, needle containers, lighting, porta-potties. These are 53-foot cargo containers that have been retrofitted with cubicle space. One of them has ended up at the Steel Bridge. The other one has been at the Hazelnut Grove camp. There was actually a story on KGW Today talking about this and highlighting some of the successes. Again, a pilot program, lessons learned here, initially met with a lot of questions from the community, but has proven to be successful so far. We're continuing to monitor that and check in with the neighbors to see how it goes. And so far, the reports have been positive. Sanctioned camping. We've worked with a Home for Everyone to develop a framework for outdoor shelters that would be managed by a nonprofit organization. And then the high-intensity street engagement program. This is intensive street outreach coupled with neighborhood response teams and public safety workers to move those with the highest barriers to service into housing. The program has successfully assisted 90 individuals and 80 households into housing placement services, and 52 individuals and 38 households have moved to permanent housing. And then lastly, in the 2015-2016 budget year, we funded a home for everyone. So with that, I want to provide that that lay of the land, that landscape for you, and some of the things that we've done in the first year. And we do have a number of people to testify, and after me will be Chair Kefouri.
Okay. Thanks, Chad. Chair Kefouri.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak with you today. I'm here to express my support for the extension of a 1 year on the housing state of emergency. And I want to briefly talk about the work that the city and the county are doing together to expand shelter, streamline homeless services, and to get thousands of people into permanent housing. But I think the most important voices that we are going to hear from today will be those people who are experiencing homelessness or those who have overcome it. Because it is the trauma of that experience, I believe, that causes us to recognize that as long as we have men, women, and children in our community sleeping in our streets, we need to recognize that we have an emergency and do everything within our power to help them. To that end, Multnomah County is working very closely with the City of Portland to expand shelter beds throughout our community. And you heard a little bit about from Chad about what has been done, but I think it's important to realize how many beds we've opened very recently. In February, we expanded our 130-bed family shelter. We opened it in a former strip club in southeast Portland, turning a neighborhood vice into a safe, welcoming place for families. This shelter has a no-turn-away policy, meaning that any family in our community that seeks shelter will find it. In July, we added 200 beds at the Hanson Shelter and another 25 beds at a new shelter for veterans. And this fall, we will open 210 additional beds, 120 at the McLaughlin Couples Shelter and 90 at a new shelter for women in Gresham. Together, that's 475 safe new shelter beds. Obviously, that is not enough, and our work is not done. But I'm also proud of the collaboration in creating the Joint Office of Homeless Services. For years, the City of Portland was responsible for homeless individuals, and the county was responsible for homeless families. And I'm sure, like many of you, that division didn't make any sense to me. If a single mother was trying to find a warm, dry place for her child to sleep, she doesn't care which government is responsible for helping her. She just needs the help. So now we have a Joint Office of Homeless Services housed at Multnomah County. Clarifying our roles as public servants is as important as our deep partnership. While the Joint Office focuses on the housing placement and wraparound services that people need to get off the streets, that work cannot succeed without the city's work to increase the number of affordable units in our community. Together, we've been able to advance our plan to address homelessness through A Home for Everyone, our countywide coalition of people who have experienced homelessness, nonprofit agencies, business and faith leaders. The emergency on our streets is not over, but the action that you are taking today will help us respond with care, compassion, and speed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kefouri.
May I ask a question, please?
Yes.
Thank you for being here, Chair Kefouri. We know that the director of the Joint Office reports directly to you. Are you comfortable with the changing in the language to require the director of the Joint Office to report every 6 months to the council?
Yes, definitely, and I hope that he is as responsive to your needs and concerns as he can be. So 6 months seems like a long time, but yes.
Thank you.
And Chair, could I just address something you said about clarifying our roles? In my office, it's called Stay in Your Lane. And we are very proud of this new partnership, and we're still working out the details. It means, I think, this council is deeply committed to getting these six-month reports. And I'm glad Commissioner Fritz just mentioned that. What I sometimes feel is missing in some of our debates, and it's a fast-moving process, is having clarity about whether an issue that we're taking up has been reviewed and or approved by the Home for Everyone Steering Committee. Mm-hmm. And second, whether the action falls within the framework of the plan that you have hammered out. And I'll just give you an example of where it's, I think, worked effectively. At budget time. And at budget time, you've come forward and others and laid out the plan and the framework for addressing the housing crisis. And we've made budget decisions based on that. And in some instances, you've even challenged us to make commitments above our resources. So that, I think, has been very productive. What's not always clear to me is where does an action before us fit within the plan, and has it been blessed by the Home for Everyone? So I don't expect you to have necessarily an answer today, but as we continue to develop and deepen the relationship, I'd like that to become as routine as we do, let's say, in an item that comes to council where we see what kind of community consultation has there been and has a neighborhood association been contacted and the like. I would like this to be as routine as the way we handle other community consultations.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I think that's one of the reasons why I am here today, to let you know personally from me my support for this and Multnomah County's support. And realizing that there is always going to be challenges moving forward, that each one of us is independently elected, and so we have our own constituencies that we are listening to. And also I think sometimes the speed that we're trying to address things, going through a bureaucratic maze, is not always going to be the best route, but that's why communication is of the most importance.
Thank you again, Chair Kifori.
Thank you.
So next we'll bring up Housing Director, Portland Housing Bureau Director Kurt Krieger, and Mark Jolin, who is the Director of the Joint Office for Homeless Services, as well as the Home for Everyone Coordinating Committee, Executive Director. Let me start with you, Mark.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mayor and members of City Council. My name is Mark Jolin. I'm with the Home for Everyone, and I am the director of the recently formed Joint Office of Homeless Services. A year ago, when you declared a state of emergency in housing and homelessness, you recognized the crisis that tens of thousands of people in our community are facing every day. You recognized that our local economy, which has improved circumstances for many, has created serious hardship for others. Unprecedented demand for rental housing and lagging supply have caused annual double-digit increases in rents at the same time that the real value of wages for the lowest-income households in our community has stagnated. This combination has pushed thousands of families to the brink of homelessness, and many are going over the edge, finding themselves living in dangerously doubled-up situations in shelters, in parks, and in vehicles all around the city. The declaration of the state of emergency galvanized our community to respond to the crisis in a way that is unprecedented in my experience. As Chad laid out in greater detail, the declaration was the foundation for a series of new and accelerated strategies designed to address the emergency on multiple fronts, to accelerate the creation of affordable housing, to expand financial and legal protections for tenants to prevent them from losing their housing, to expand the safe spaces, shelter spaces, for people who become homeless, and to significantly expand programs to help people who are experiencing homelessness get back into housing and keep that housing. Many of these are long-term strategies already laid out in the Action Plan for Home for Everyone, our unified community plan to end homelessness. But in the face of the emergency, this council, joined by the County Commission, Home Forward, and scores of community partners, committed to dramatically accelerating the implementation of these strategies. We are now in the midst of that implementation, and the indicators that led you to declare a state of emergency are still very much present. Portland continues to have among the fastest growing housing prices in the country and among the nation's lowest vacancy rates. The Portland Tribune reported in March that Portland saw a 14% increase in the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment to over $1,300 a month, the highest percentage increase of any city in the country. These increases far outpace any gains in income for low-wage households and leave people on fixed incomes, like Social Security disability, unable to maintain the housing they have, and if they are already homeless, unable to find a place they can afford. These trends, along with the continued lack of prioritization at the federal level of affordable housing development, income supports, and services for vulnerable populations, explain why 211 Info, our community's information referral line, reports that they have taken more than 21,000 calls for shelter and housing-related services since the beginning of the state of emergency, including an average of 1,300 calls a month from people who self-identify as homeless. Calls for housing and shelter services to 211 have gone from 35% of their call volume to 50% of their call volume in just the last 3 years. It's also why between December of 2015 and June of 2016, the average number of nightly residents at our Human Solutions No Turn Away Family Shelter increased from 116 people per night to 146 people per night, an increase of almost 30% over just 7 months. It's why Transition Projects has 1,000 people on their adult shelter waiting list, including 300 women, and why visits to their day center are up 17% over what they were 2 years ago. And overall, our publicly funded shelter providers reported that from July 2015 through June of 2016, almost 6,000 people accessed emergency shelter, nearly a 50% increase over the last 3 years, And that number doesn't count the people who sought shelter at Portland Rescue Mission, City Team Ministries, and in places like Dignity Village and Right to Dream 2. Unfortunately, the data also suggests that the vast majority of people who enter shelter are not able to exit shelter to permanent housing because we have such a desperate shortage of available affordable units for our lowest income residents. That is why when Home Forward opened its public housing waiting lists earlier this summer, over 8,000 people submitted over 22,000 applications just to get on the waiting lists for various buildings. As these statistics indicate, there is no question that for tens of thousands of Portlanders who are homeless or in housing crisis today, the emergency is real and ongoing. Your decision to extend the state of emergency will help sustain the critical momentum we have to implement policies and expand program capacity to help them through this crisis. On the shelter front, as you've heard, we committed to achieving the Home for Everyone goal to increase shelter options by at least 650 beds, more than doubling the publicly supported shelter capacity in our community by the end of fiscal year 2017. With the flexibility and new resources allocated during this year under the state of emergency, we're on track to achieve this goal, but there is a lot of continued effort, investment, and code reform needed to finish the job and sustain our progress. As important as shelter is as one part of our response to this emergency, we will only truly address the crisis if we significantly decrease the number of people who are losing their housing and becoming homeless, and if we dramatically increase our capacity to help people move out of shelter and back into permanent housing. With the declaration of the state of emergency, we committed to achieving the ambitious Home for Everyone goals of having programs in place by the end of 2017 to prevent at least 5,000 people a year from becoming homeless, and helping at least 4,350 people a year move off the streets and back into permanent housing. We've begun to build that program capacity and scale up resources to achieve these outcomes, but we've only begun. And beyond expanded homeless prevention and housing placement services, we need to continue the focus that the state of emergency has brought to rapidly increasing the supply of affordable housing units. Our ending homelessness strategies depend on significantly increasing the supply of deeply affordable and permanent supportive housing, and Director Krieger will speak to these efforts. We see daily in the faces of the people in our shelters, on our streets, and in our eviction courtrooms the human toll of this housing crisis. Under the state of emergency, we are moving critical long-term strategies and investments forward at an unprecedented rate. In doing so, we are helping tens of thousands of people a year, and we are also setting an example for our state and federal partners, without whom we will not be able to truly resolve this crisis. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Krieger?
Director Krieger? Can I ask a question?
Yeah, question.
Mark, I talk to people periodically who just don't believe that people are homeless because housing prices are rising. They understand housing prices are rising, they understand people are homeless, but they just refuse to believe that there's much of a connection. And I think there is a connection, but I'd love to have more statistics to give them to say, for example, here's what percentage of people who are homeless now are people who had a home a year ago, but their rents went up and they couldn't find another place. Mm-hmm. So I think I asked you that a while ago when you said you didn't have the numbers offhand. I was curious if you have that.
So we don't have the data parsed out in that particular way. So that in the street count that we'll do in January, in part because you've asked this question, we'll be incorporating the kind of primary causality questions. I think we know from our providers, we know, for example, from our family shelter providers that a significant majority of the families they're seeing are reporting that they're homeless for the first time, that the cause of their homelessness was very much an economic crisis. We know from our providers that are trying to help people find housing that if someone is on less than $800 a month in long-term disability and rents for one-bedroom apartments are $1,300, that financial piece is an essential barrier to their ability to get back into housing. What we also know is if there's a housing unit available that someone can afford, we can provide the support service to help them stay housed. If they don't have the money to pay the rent, all the support services in the world will not keep them in housing. And that's just fundamentally what's at stake.
Okay. I really appreciate getting more of a breakdown.
Yep.
in January. I should also note that the Tribune did a poll on housing affordability and homelessness a few weeks ago, and I think that their data with people in the metro area also show that a lot of people think the primary reason for homelessness is unemployment or mental health issues and a number of issues, and not very many of them thought it was simply the rising cost of housing. So it's not just anecdotal. It appears to be there's a fair number of people in the metro area, the general public, who would like, who I think would like to know the data.
Sure. Yeah, and the cause that the causes are interwoven, right? Because there may be a variety of reasons why someone is struggling to earn an income that would allow them to pay the rent. But we also know that rents are escalating to the point now where someone who is working full time in a minimum wage job still can't afford the rent. So, I think that the financial piece will always be a contributing cause, and why someone is struggling to have the income that they would need to pay the rent is going to be specific to their circumstance. But right now, the rents are beyond what even folks who are able to find full-time work can afford in many cases.
Mark, I have a comment and a question. I wholeheartedly agree with what you said, that long-term, the solution to this crisis is expanding the supply of affordable homes.
Mm-hmm.
In the short term, we made a commitment to expand our shelter capacity because we believe that a shelter is a better and safer place in some instances than being on the street. But that's not our long-term plan.
Right.
Shelter is just a piece of the plan. Can you just very briefly explain to us how a one-year extension versus what we were initially, I think, the default was going to be, which was a six-month extension, how does a one-year extension strengthen your hand in terms of finding available shelter space over the next year?
So I think in part what the state of emergency and certainly having another year of it, it sustains that intensive focus that the state of emergency declaration has brought to this effort. As we go out to look for spaces for shelter, the ability to make a year-long commitment to a space as opposed
certainty.
To just, so there's a level of certainty there. Whenever we identify a shelter site, it's going to require some level of financial investment, some program development, and the more sustainable that shelter is, the more cost-effective those investments become. So we're looking at that opportunity to not only expand, but then also do the work of stabilizing the shelters over time that are not just temporary, that we expect to have as permanent shelters.
So could I ask a follow-up question about that? How many of the shelters that we've opened have used the state of emergency to waive elements of the zoning code?
So the shelters we've been able to expand under in the last year have all taken advantage of the sort of temporary use provisions that are allowed under the code. So the state of emergency becomes a platform for that. It allows for the continuation of that temporary use, in essence.
For longer than 6 months.
Right.
So I'm wondering if we need a further amendment in the substitute, because it says that the council waives all applicable provisions of Title 33, other than the temporary general activities general regulations, to allow the city to site up to 5-day storage units at several
mm-hmm.
locations.
Mm-hmm.
So we've actually waived everything except the temporary activities for some of the shelters, too, right?
I'm not sure I follow the question. It may be a question for the city attorney rather than for me. I don't know what is required in terms of the provisions of the ordinance in that
part
sense.
Part of my understanding is that we need to extend the state of emergency to allow the shelters to continue to operate. And I'm wondering, the previous ordinance also had something about we're just waiving the zoning code for storage facilities. And so I'm wondering where it gets to we can do this in our longer term. Maybe Director Kruger can answer this. I'm just trying to figure out how does the state of emergency affect the zoning code and the temporary activities rules.
So again, so my understanding is that the state of emergency allows us to create a presumption in favor of being able to allow us to continue the temporary use to stabilize those shelters.
Okay, so it's possible that the city attorneys might need to advise us on putting that in
okay.
black and white in the yeah. ordinance. Thank you.
Director Krieger.
Good afternoon, members of council and Mayor Hales by phone. Kurt Krieger, Director of the Housing Bureau. I'd like to speak to some of the permanent housing aspects of your emergency declaration and speak specifically in support of the substitute ordinance that has been proffered. Specifically, I'd like to mention the GATOR, the so-called Governmental Accountability and Transparency Review Process that was launched by Mayor Hales and Commissioner Salzman. Since we were increasing the available funding for housing development and housing preservation, we needed to make process improvements to the way in which PBOT, the Bureau of Development Services, the Housing Bureau work together with planning and sustainability to compress the time of permit approval. And the GATOR process is the means by which that has come about in the last 6 months. It was specifically convened in response to the state of emergency. And the directors of our sister bureaus were all convened by the mayor and Commissioner Salzman to identify ways in which we could tangibly shorten the period of time from project application to project approval. And I'd like to say that we are making good progress in that regard. For instance, simple things that really have been helpful is that the 8 newly funded projects in the so-called NOFA, the Notice of Funding Availability, as the applicant applies for their permits, the Housing Bureau is listed as a co-applicant. So we're on the front sheet of the permit application as the Housing Bureau, which signals to the Bureau of Development Services that that project will receive priority processing. The allocation of resources inside of BDS is a daily optimization effort, and housing is getting priority treatment as a result. I think we will see tangible results. However, it's early in that process, so I can't report yet what they are, but we're looking for months, not days, of savings. The other thing I'd like to speak to is the design review improvements that are embedded in your emergency declaration. Up till the state of emergency, projects that went through a Type 3 were often stuck in an interminable loop of review by the Design Commission. The Type 2X process was a way by which to short-circuit and compress the time needed to make sure that projects met City of Portland design standards. The Type 2X process is currently designed as a staff review appealable to the Design Commission. And we have 2 projects that are preparing to submit for a review under that new auspices. It's taken a few months because they have to prepare working drawings for their projects to get to this point. But specifically, River Place Parcel 3 by Bridge Housing and Raleigh at 14th and Raleigh by Innovative Housing, Inc. are coming forward to utilize that new process improvement. Third, I'd like to say that in large part, our success in Salem with Senate Bill 1533 was the state of emergency. It allowed Mayor Hales, Commissioner Salzman, and myself to speak very clearly and very bluntly about the help that we needed from our state legislators. And as mentioned earlier, a 17-year prohibition on inclusionary zoning has been lifted as a result of that. And frankly, as we move forward to implement inclusionary housing policies, which are referenced herein with some deadlines, it poises us for another productive year in Salem. I'd like to go to Salem first day of session next year with everything having been prepared for enactment or enacted by the City Council before we ask for tenant protections. And we know that increased tenant protections will be a major priority, or anticipate that they will be a major priority. So our focus and our singular attention to this matter, I think, is in large part due to the fact that you declared the emergency, state legislators heard you, they want to be helpful and have responded in kind. To respond in part to the question proposed by Commissioner Novick, the Housing Bureau prepares the state of housing, and we will release one this winter for 2016. We are specifically doing some deep dives into economic displacement, and one area of special concern of mine is the number of units that have been converted from month-to-month rentals to short-term rentals. There are some 2,700 whole homes offered on the short-term rental market in Portland. We think about 1,000 of those had been heretofore affordable month-to-month available rentals. If you take 1,000 units out of the housing ecosystem in Portland, that's a value of about $380 million. It would cost that much to replace 1,000 units. So what you're seeing through homelessness on the streets is some of these ripples, if you will, in the market rate housing, which cram people into the affordable market. They're competing for fewer and fewer available units. And, of course, the people with the least means to compete in that marketplace are often the most vulnerable, the disabled, the people least able to cope with economic forces that we're faced with.
Did you say $380 million?
That's what I said.
I mean, that's really striking because I think that one of the quandaries we've had in enforcing the rules we have on short-term rentals is that enforcement takes bodies to go out and do inspections, and it costs money. But if you're talking about that kind of return in terms of affordable housing, then spending a significant amount on enforcement might be well worth it.
I think enforcement will more than pay for itself. And we're happy to come forward to the council with more specific data in this regard. But we're receiving cooperation in part from the short-term rental platforms and from Portland State University in this regard.
You know, in fairness, cooperation from the short-term rental platforms, if they took a page out of the way Uber and Lyft participate with the city, would be very simple. They would simply agree that no one would be able to advertise a unit on their platform unless they had independently verified they were in compliance with city law. To the credit of Uber and Lyft, and I've had my issues with both, they don't allow their drivers on the platform unless it's been established that they have a license. That's the one difference, and it seems to me and there's a chasm between those two industries. And if we could get the short-term rental industry to behave as responsibly in this area as Lyft and Uber, then at least we would be able to say to the guests that we are reasonably confident that you're moving in, that you are occupying a safe unit. Without it, they're making money at the top and shifting the risk to the customer. And that, to me, is irresponsible.
Well, another profound thing that I don't want to dwell upon because this isn't a fair housing hearing, but there's quite a lot of national evidence that the exchange between a host and a guest is racially biased because the profile of the guest is visible to the host. And in blind treatments, using names that are customarily associated with people of color, there has been a marked increase in the amount of racial discrimination. We're especially cognizant of that, and we're looking for means by which disparate impact can be demonstrated, either through racial or for people with disabilities. So we're mindful, and we'll continue to monitor that.
Thank you.
This concludes my remarks.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from council? Okay.
I'd like to follow up and see if you have an answer to my question about the shelters.
Well, I don't. I was reading the ordinance, and I know the city attorney was directly involved with drafting of this ordinance. I know that each of the commissioner's offices were directly involved. I think it's covered in the detail, and by raising this, and perhaps by the end of the meeting, we'll have a response.
My understanding is it is covered. But, Kurt, could you and the city attorney get together and reassure us of that?
Well, specifically, under 1504040, the Declaration of the State of Emergency, it says that a housing emergency is a health and safety emergency under Portland City Code in 33. Mass shelters are allowed as temporary activities for the duration of the emergency subject to the standards in 33. 296040. And I brought that up during the discussion about Terminal 1 because, in some ways, it's unfortunate that it says that that we're not waiving those standards and those don't allow any kind of permanent improvements, which seems like a complete waste of taxpayers' money to have a shelter operating for a year using porta potties when you could probably do it much as cheaply and have proper shower and bathroom facilities. So that's something that if the city attorney could get back to me before the end of the hearing, because, you know, we want to have a holistic solution, and we don't want to not waste any money anywhere. Mm-hmm. So either we say that we have to figure out the whole part about what's allowed under a housing emergency and what improvements are allowed under temporary activities.
Well, that's helpful. I'll cite the Terminal 1. Under the current law, and it has not been challenged in LUBA, so we'll have to wait for that legal process. But in light of the R2-D2 decision and in light of what we know about our code, there potentially can be a temporary shelter there as long as there are no improvements made to the warehouse. if there are improvements made to the warehouse, and that violates our code. And that's because the use is, by definition, a temporary use that is sanctioned under the emergency where we're waiving some things. But once it becomes more permanent, then you run afoul of what Luba said, that made the R2-D2 move to the Central East Side illegal. So that's the line. And, I mean, I have many reasons why I think T1 is a bad idea. But in the short term, there can be no changes, substantial changes to the site. Otherwise, it runs afoul of our code.
And Mayor Hales, are you still with us?
I sure am.
Great. The ordinance doesn't need to be renewed until October. That the housing state of emergency doesn't need to be renewed until October. Is that correct?
That's right. But obviously, we wanted to have time for it to go into effect with the usual 30-day ordinance period.
Oh, right. Well, perhaps what we should do today is hear the testimony from everybody and see if we do have complete consensus on the council so that we could perhaps take another week to be thinking about doing it as an or even longer than a week, do it as an emergency, but having all kinds of discussion, particularly as Commissioner Fish said in light of the Right to Dream 2 decision from the Land Use Board of Appeals yesterday, that I think does have significance. Implications for shelters everywhere and for, again, wise use of taxpayers' money.
Can I make a suggestion? We're not going to take today's, we have a substitute ordinance that says we're extending the clock without making substantive changes. My strong recommendation is.
Right. The question was whether, Commissioner Chris, I think, has raised a good point, and that is given those new developments, if there's a likelihood or an understanding on the council that we're going to unanimously support an extension of the. Emergency declaration, then that can be done as an emergency ordinance rather than as a conventional ordinance and not have the 30-day period. So I'm certainly open to that scenario if that's where, after this hearing, the consensus of the council lies.
Yeah, and once if the council does agree to extend by the year, which I think there's broad agreement, it seems to me if there's other tweaks to the code that anyone wants to consider, we could bring that back as a separate package.
Correct.
Okay, thank you both. And we're going to, our final invited guests are George Devendorf, Executive Director of Transition Projects, Inc., Shannon Singleton, Executive Director of JOIN, Ibrahim Mubarak, Right to Dream 2, and Israel Baer of Street Roots. I don't know if we have enough chairs for all four of you. It'd be nice if we had a fourth chair.
I think Israel's here.
Yeah, Israel's here. Okay, great. Excellent. Okay. Why don't we start with you, George?
Great. Thanks very much and good afternoon. The message I'm hoping to offer you this afternoon with regards to...
Oh, give us your name.
Sorry. Yeah. George Devendorf, Executive Director of Transition Projects. So my message with regards to the state of emergency, I believe, is relatively straightforward, and that is stay the course. The state of emergency over the past year, and I would say the momentum that it's generated, have achieved... quite a bit. But those achievements need to be sustained because, as we all know, and has been said by everyone here today, our homelessness crisis remains with us. So with that in mind, I wanted to offer a couple of insights and perhaps make a recommendation or two as you deliberate this issue. And I wanted to focus my remarks particularly on shelter, which has come up a few times. My colleagues here and throughout this hearing will quite rightly emphasize the long-term overriding importance of housing and affordable housing in this issue, and I wholeheartedly concur with them, but wanted to mention a couple of things about our efforts which have drawn quite a bit of attention specifically around shelter. So the first is that the demand for shelter remains extremely strong. During the past year, Transition Projects succeeded in helping over 800 individuals formerly homeless to regain their housing. And that represents an all-time high in our agency's almost 50-year history. Unfortunately, we've also been experiencing all-time highs in some other categories, including the number of people that we're helping each day in our day center in Bud Clark Commons, and also the number of people on our waiting list to access our long-term shelter. And so those wait times, which were referenced earlier, amount to 6 months for men or women trying to access our long-term shelter, not housing, but shelter. And tellingly, those wait times have not gone down during the state of emergency, even as our community has made great strides in adding additional shelter space. And I think that's an important indicator for the demand that's out there. We also know that folks outside, many of them, want to come inside. And we know that in part from the survey work we do in our day center, where, among other things, 87% of those in the day center who are sleeping outside have signaled to us that they would avail themselves of shelter if it were available to them. But we also know it from the past month, where our mobile engagement team has been very active in the Spring Water Corridor and has already helped 20 individuals living in the corridor to find space in the Hanson shelter, temporary emergency shelter, and have identified 30 others who would like to access space there once that space becomes available, something that will hopefully happen during the month of September. Second point relates to the accessibility of shelter. So during the state of emergency, this community has more so than in the past embraced a low-barrier, come-as-you-are approach to offering shelter to those who need it most. And that embrace has really enabled us to offer people living on the streets three of the most important things that a shelter could offer, and that is the three Ps, right? So their partners, their pets, and their possessions. And to the extent that we can offer that, we literally open the door to scores of individuals living outside who previously have found the idea of coming inside to be untenable because of oftentimes those three Ps. So this has been an important, I think, shift or reprioritization in the way that we're offering safe places for people to sleep. My third point relates to flow through, and that's something we often talk about. We all know that shelter is only valuable insofar as it plays a meaningful role in helping someone to regain housing. Flow through, in this case, referring to our ability as a community to ensure that those who are going through shelter have a reasonable chance and all the assistance we can offer to help them achieve that housing goal. During the past year, during the state of emergency, we noticed in my agency alone that we were able, our ability to place guests in our long-term shelters into permanent housing increased substantially. So 2 years ago, about 27% of guests coming out of our long-term shelter went into permanent housing. Last fiscal year, that number went up to 41%. So it's a 14% increase in placement rate just over 1 year. And that kind of success in flow through is directly attributable to the decisions taken by local and federal leaders to prioritize housing assistance funding. I can't overstate how important that is as we look at providing quick, temporary, and immediate forms of support to people living on the street. If we're going to continue to move that needle forward in the coming years, we're going to need, in this housing market, to make very strong and continue to make strong investments in housing and in the development of not only rental assistance but affordable housing. Finally, I think the way forward, the one comment I'd make is that the state of emergency has brought a sprinter's sense of urgency to the way this community has been addressing homelessness, and I think that's been a really good thing. It's helped to galvanize attention. It's spurred very timely and I'd say well-coordinated work on the part of governmental actors, and it's increased public support and volunteerism for our efforts. But the reality is we're not really just looking at a single sprint. We're looking at a series of sprints that will have to be sustained in the coming years and supported and really championed by this city council and the city councils that will follow it. So in the coming years, I would simply recommend that we continue to focus our attention and dedicate significant resource in three smart investment areas: shelter, rental assistance, and deeply affordable housing. Deeply because although our community has made strides in directing more resourcing towards affordable housing, we know that if we want to have a positive impact on the most vulnerable in our community, we need to be prioritizing housing that is affordable to those on the street looking to end their homelessness and regain their housing. Thanks very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Ms. Shannon, why don't you go ahead and just give us your name and affiliation?
I'm Shannon Singleton. I'm the executive director of JOIN. And I'm just here to give a little bit of information about JOIN and what we're seeing on the streets. A lot of folks know that JOIN works with people who are sleeping in cars and on the streets in our community and helps them move back into housing. But we're also supporting a number of households who we've worked with in the past to help them try and maintain their housing. Right now, I would say that JOIN is not of a lack of people to serve, but we're at a terrible lack of affordable units for people to move into. In addition to that, we're seeing whole building evictions. We're seeing rent increases that are completely unaffordable for the people who may have been stable in their housing for 5, 6, 7 years. With the extension of this state of emergency, the council will affirm that not only what is a personal crisis for many individuals in Portland, but is also a crisis for our city as a whole. The rate of rent increases, the request for double and sometimes triple deposit for apartments, requiring income that is 3 times the monthly rent in order to rent a unit, in addition to other screening barriers, is not only preventing people from moving inside, but also pushing people into homelessness. I hope the council commits to not only continuing the work to expand safety off the streets options, but also addresses the affordable housing need as well as the tenant protection issues that have been far too long ignored. I implore you to use this ordinance as a mechanism to address this housing crisis and continue the work that has started in this past year. And I'm going to end instead of repeating everything that you've already heard from everyone who spoke before me.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mubarak?
Here we go again.
Give us your name.
Ibrahim Mubarak. I'm CEO of Right to Survive and chairman of Right to Dream 2. What we deal with is people that are torn and broken and tired. And you want to bring a state of emergency, which you had once, and the other grassroots organizations like Hazelnut Grove, Lost Round, Dignity Village, and Right to Dream 2 went out telling the people who was living on the streets in the Springwater Quarter, in bushes and vacant houses, cars and RVs, that it's okay to sleep on the street for a certain amount of time. And then the police came and arrested and swept people. So I really don't trust this unless it's written. You say it on the news and everybody know and tell the police to stop sweeping the people if this is going to go. And it should go for more than a year. It should go until we have a solution, not an in the meantime solution for people to get inside. You're putting all these money into all these organizations, all these and ifs and buts. You need to make affordable housing, subsidized housing. You need to stop the rent raid, put a rent freeze on where people who work and live on the streets can afford apartments. If you bring more affordability, I believe you'll put a 30% cut in houselessness on the street. If you bring more subsidized housing instead of high condos, you'll put at least 40% in a rate. You make family institutions for families to go into places, for people with pets to go into places. You are cut by 50% of people living on the streets. You want emergency housing and houseless act, then why are you sweeping the Springwater Quarter? Where are those people going to go? Why did Aluva stop Right to Dream 2 from moving to a spot where we can provide more places for houseless people? Why are you trying to move right Hazelnut Grove and Forgotten Ram? You need to make more RV camps for people who live in there and make spaces for people who live in the cars. I know you tried to do that before, but the neighborhood association, they got to realize that we are their neighbors. We should be involved in the neighborhood association. If we're going to make plans for people that's affected, you need people with more the grassroots community in these plans making things, because we know what it is that can make us successful. You need to start recycling knowledge and not just bottles and bricks and wood and cardboard. You need to recycle knowledge, because the houses community do know things, and they do know things how to get inventive to make them more productive. So this act that you're trying to pass, this emergency thing, it'll only work if we can sit at the table and help you tweak the messages and the things that need to be done in there. And you need to make Adamy reach the police and tell them to stop sweeping people and stop the landlord for raising the price of rent.
Thank you. Okay, this is Mr. Bear. Just give us your name.
Hi, my name is Israel Bear, and I'm with Street Roots. Thank you for having me today. I came less today to talk about the substance of the ordinance and to just say that, an emergency in the context of homelessness and housing has been happening in our community for people of color and poor people for 40 years. And it is, really just this mayor and all of you that have taken responsibility for the first time for that crisis. And we could debate until we're